From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. My guest today describes herself first as Iranian American. She is then Muslim. After that, she's an author, attorney, and activist. She is also a visiting professor of creative writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And it's that last descriptor, her status as a UNCW faculty member, that grants me the great gift of having Melody Moisey on our local public affairs show. Today, we'll explore her latest work through the lens of her ethnicity, culture, and career success, which is considerable. We'll also learn about her battle with mental illness, which, as we'll discover, transformed into one of the gifts that led her to explore the mystic poetry of Rumi, a 13th century scholar and theologian from the Middle East. Melody Moisey has written for NPR, CNN, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Christian Science Monitor. That's hardly an exhaustive list. She is also the author of three books, War on Error, Real Stories of American Muslims, and Haldol and Hyacinths, A Bipolar Life. But it's her most recent book, out last month, we're exploring today, The Rumi Prescription, How an Ancient Mystic Poet Changed My Modern Manic Life. Melody Moisey, what a pleasure it is to welcome you to Coastline.
Thanks so much for having me, Rachel.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Is self-isolation giving you time for deeper pursuits? Are you one of the people forced into a slower pace of living? How is it affecting you? Tell us about it. Or if you have a question for Melody Moisey, you can reach us today via email at coastline@whqr.org. That's during the live Wednesday discussion. I'm still broadcasting from a home studio, so we can't take phone calls. But again, our email address during the live Wednesday discussion is coastline@whqr.org. Melody Moisey, you say that when you started out to write this book, you thought this was about reclaiming a cultural and literary inheritance in the hopes of overcoming, in your words, a nasty case of writer's block. In other words, you were taking this very rational, intellectual, strategic approach to writing a book that would sell. But you realized in the process that this was about something else. What was that?
Ultimately, it was about love. And I'm not a fluffy kind of person. I'm very, very left brain. So I wanted it very organized. I plan out my life so clearly, I mean, day by day, to the point that people make fun of me, like my plans look like that. So I had this plan, and like most, you know, great plans, God laughed in the face of it. And this ended up taking years longer than I anticipated and turning into a book that I didn't think it was going to turn into. But I'm so glad that it arrived where it arrived.
And it's interesting, too, because this cultural and literary heritage of yours is something, because you grew up with it and your father was reciting Rumi's verse to you all the time as a kid, you kind of resented it. And in the early part of your adult life, which one could argue you're still in, you kind of rejected it and came back to this. What brought you back to Rumi and your father as your guide through Rumi's work?
Yeah, I say in the book that my dad being a Rumi addict, I, like most children of addicts, grew to resent the object of my father's addiction. So that's what happened with Rumi. Also, Rumi's verse is to modern day Farsi what Shakespeare is to modern day English. So it's not easily understandable, especially for a 9-year-old, you know, but he would just recite this stuff to me, and frequently the poems would be similar. I'd heard them before, and I was a brat. I was a kid. So I would just roll my eyes and be like, I've heard this before, but I never, like most things that are that familiar, you think you know them, but there's something about familiarity or that kind of familiarity that sort of blinds you to what's actually there. And that's basically what was happening to me.
Now, you say that in Iran, every citizen, regardless of generation or education or station in life, grows up knowing some Rumi. And of course, we know the work is enjoying a rebirth of sorts in the Western world. Why do you think so many thousands of years later, Rumi is finding this incredibly broad new audience?
You know, personally, I think it has to do with what has happened to our culture and how we're constantly seeking answers from outside of ourselves. And not just answers, like fixes for everything. Like it, as though every problem we have can be fixed by something you can go order on Amazon. Like it, there's a fix for that. There's an app for that. You know, like there's something that can fix it in our society that can be purchased or bartered or traded within our economy, you know? So like, I think that has something to do with it. I think recognizing that all of this experience of looking outward and pursuing things like money, notoriety, whatever you want to call it, celebrity, which is just so big in our culture, that all of it is just so empty. And I think we recognize that as human beings really deep down. But with so much advertising being thrown at us every single day, it's so easy to forget and to not realize how much all that advertising affects us, even as adults.
And that's something that most Americans can really relate to. We've heard that message in other ways as well. But paint the picture for us of you growing up in Ohio, was it? You were born and raised in this country, your parents born and raised in Iran, and Ahmad, of course, your father, like many Iranian citizens familiar with Rumi, he especially was passionate about Rumi. So what was that like in your Ohio household?
Well, so I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, which was such a great place to grow up. I had a huge community of other Iranian Americans who, after the revolution, had been recruited to come, mostly doctors and professionals, engineers, that sort of thing. And my parents are both physicians, so that's how we came here. And growing up in Dayton with that community was amazing because I was never the only Iranian kid in school. Like, I don't have the same story as some of my friends who grew up in other places have. And also, people have this assumption that if you grew up in Dayton, Ohio, you must have been the only Iranian kid at school, you know? But it was the furthest thing from the truth. And I think partly like an example of what makes America so great is that not only did we have this large Iranian diaspora there, we had a large Korean diaspora, an Egyptian diaspora, Indian diaspora. So people came to these small towns to raise their families. And I couldn't imagine a better place to grow up. So I'm really grateful for that. And the privilege of being able to grow up there taught me the danger of judging people on so many levels, because I think after leaving Ohio, something about growing up in Ohio is you just want to leave. Like that, I think that's the gift it gives you, is you're just like, get me the hell out of here as quickly as possible. And you think the rest of the world is better or different, or, you know, just over time you realize that a lot of places are the same. Like the weather here is better. A lot of things in other places are better. But in terms of the people, like just really solid, amazing people who are not at all the way that the media portrays them. And I felt exactly the same way about my family in Iran, right? So I feel like the media portrays people from the middle of the country, not LA or New York, as just being ignorant, right? And I feel like people have similar misconceptions about Iran. And it's, you know, this idea of flyover states. The problem with flying over us is you never get to know us. And in my writing, my hope is that I'm helping people get to know people that they might not otherwise get to know, because they are literally flying over us a lot of the time.
Yeah, and that sounded almost like the beginning of a quatrain. But let's talk about Rumi's poetry for a moment, because you explain that it's not meant to just be read.
Yeah, so Rumi was the first of the whirling dervishes, as we know them. And he didn't start that order. It was started after he died. I don't think he's the type who would have started an order and say, follow me. But yeah, so the poetry is meant to be sung, and it's a gift, like it's a talent. Some people are really good at it, others are not. I am not at all close to good at it. my dad is amazing at it. But you
your dad actually sings it to you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's cadences more like that. But when we're at parties and things like that, you know, musical instruments come. I don't know why I said, most people maybe don't know this. Musical instruments come out. And the rest of my, you know, friends and family in Dayton where we were growing up, like a lot of these parties, that was our form of worship, where, you know, we didn't have a certain house of worship to go to, but we had these really amazing kinds of gatherings where toward the end people would start reciting poetry, and usually that was my dad, and there were people who were really good at dancing and they would do that, and there were people who were good at drums and they would, you know, everyone had their instrument or their talent. So yeah, that's what this poetry is meant to be, sung while spinning, not read while sitting. And that's a hard thing, I think, for a lot of Westerners or so-called Westerners to grasp.
And so you talk about the fact that there is this marked difference between Islamic fundamentalism. So in your community, you used Rumi's poetry as a form of worship, part of your Muslim heritage and practice. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are many Americans who are not Muslim, think of the fundamentalist part of Islam when they hear about Islam. So I'm going to have you kind of unpack the difference and who the Sufis were and the mystics. You call them lovers. Mm. You're listening to Coastline. Have you read the work of 13th century mystic poet Rumi? We're talking with Melody Moisey today, a visiting professor at UNCW and author of The Rumi Prescription. And we're taking your questions during the live Wednesday discussion. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. You can ask your own question by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The Rumi Prescription by Melody Moisey is part memoir, part spiritual pilgrimage, perhaps part self-help manual. The author, who is also a visiting professor of creative writing at UNCW, is with us today and taking your questions during the live Wednesday discussion. You can reach us via email at coastline@whqr.org. And just a reminder, phone lines are not open while we broadcast from a home studio. And Melody, just before we went to break, I was asking you about the difference between what a lot of Americans think about when they hear Muslim or an Islamic tradition. They think of fundamentalism. Your Rumi comes from the Sufi tradition, the mystics. So help us understand kind of the theological difference or philosophical difference there.
Right. I mean, I think just like a lot of perception of Christians comes, especially up north, or with atheists, for instance, like there are certain notions of if you say you're evangelical, like people immediately have these stereotypes. Like same thing when you say you're Muslim, there are immediately a whole host of stereotypes that have nothing to do whether you're Sufi or just Muslim, Shia or Sunni, or non, you know, don't pick one of those sects either. There's a group of Muslims who are Quranists who really don't fall within either of those, for instance. But this Sufi mentality is what I really focused on in the book. And Sufis being the mystics of Islam, the people who were more interested in the core of things, the center of things, as opposed to the peel. They want to get to the heart of everything, and they're sort of in a rush to do so. And for Sufis, everything really boils down to love. And they let others peddle in all these worldly trifles and let them trade over, you know, the rotting rinds and peel of whatever theology is out there, right? Whereas Sufis are enjoying the fruit of devotion and they're savoring that sweetness. So it's not about religious rules and regulations. Rumi says, forget religious rules and regulations, let your heart conduct communications. So I think that's why people of so many faiths have found his poetry so comforting and powerful for them, because it's beyond any specific faith. But it was really important to me to say that this tradition, that Rumi was an Islamic scholar, and this tradition is deeply Islamic. So some of the translations in English really wipe the Islam clean from Rumi's poetry, and it's everywhere. There's so many allusions and references to the Quran specifically. So for me to be able to say, look at this poet you love so much, look at this poet you post on Instagram, look at this poet you know is all about love, and remember that he's Muslim. This is a Muslim refugee. And if you love him so much, what's so wrong with the rest of us, right? And that's a little message that I wanted to sort of squeeze into the book, which did make its way in there.
And you segment your book into afflictions, human afflictions, wanting, mm-hmm. isolation, depression, haste, distraction, anger, pride. And some people might say, oh, that's just the human experience. Those aren't illnesses to be cured. But you explain to us why these are afflictions to be solved instead of emotions, or maybe emotions to be felt and experienced.
I think they are emotions to be felt and experienced. They aren't afflictions in so much as they get in our way, right? I'm not calling any of them clinical, or one of them is depression, for instance, but what I'm talking about is not necessarily clinical depression, though there can be overlap, but the kind of depression that we all feel, right? All of these emotions are emotions we all feel, and sort of part of the inspiration for this book was the notion that as somebody with bipolar disorder who knows what it's like to have a serious mental health condition, I can also look at so-called normal people and realize there's a kind of illness, there's a kind of hurt within a lot of us that doesn't have, it's not clinical, it's not pathological, but it's almost more dangerous because it's so deeply ingrained and acceptable. And that's why I start the book off with the diagnosis of wanting, which is just wanting more and never having enough. And I'm still guilty of that. And all of these different diagnoses are things that I experience on a daily basis back and forth. So they're not something that you can cure and get rid of. They're something that you need to learn the lesson that it has to teach you. So Rumi has a poem where he says, welcome every guest, no matter how grotesque. Be as hospitable to calamity as to ecstasy, to anxiety as to tranquility. Today's misery sweeps your home clean, making way for tomorrow's felicity. And that's every one of these diagnoses is one of those guests that's visiting us. And we need to be hospitable and learn the lesson that it has to teach us instead of running away from it, which is in numbing ourselves out, which is something a lot of us do. And I've certainly been guilty of that as well.
You talk in your book about a point at which your father told you to allow the guest of sadness. And you were afraid that if you did that, you would be in a ball on the couch sobbing for days and would never emerge.
Yeah.
But you tried it. And what happened?
Yeah, it was pretty amazing, because I don't know why I thought I would never stop. The thing about depression is it carries a delusion with it too, right? That you're always going to feel like this and you always felt like this, you know? That's the worst delusion that comes with depression. And I think in that chapter, I had lost a friend to suicide, and my dad was trying to explain to me that the way that I get through that isn't to run away from my grief, but rather to feel it. And if I feel like I need to cry. And he's actually, I mentioned he's a physician. So when he says to me, listen, there is no better sedative on earth than tears, than crying. And if you have access to it and you're doing it, why wouldn't you not use it? And there are no side effects, right? It's a natural reaction. And we're taught not to give in to that, or that if we do, it's a sign of weakness as opposed to strength. And for him, it's not. It's a sign of listening to your emotion and emotional maturity to be able to cry when you need to cry.
And almost finding the healing by going through the emotion and allowing it and experiencing it rather than trying to shift it or repress it or rise above it. You write, if Rumi had taken lithium or lamotrigine, would he have been able to find the beloved in between? Would the side effects have disturbed his singing and whirling routine? Would his diction, rhyme, and meter have lost their sheen? Would he have been just another scholar regressing toward the mean? That last line is my favorite. But so this is part of allowing the guests instead of medicating them out of your experience. How do you, as someone who has been very open about your battle with mental illness and diagnoses, how do you figure out that line between allowing it and walking through it and medicating it?
Yeah, I think medication for me has been such a gift, and I'm very grateful for it. What I wasn't grateful for was the way the American mental health system basically disregarded my faith as a tool to help me heal. What I also didn't appreciate is how some members of my faith community disregarded my medical diagnosis as garbage and saying, you must be either possessed or they're making it up, you know? So there is a place in between where faith and medicine can meet. And I was finding that the messages I was getting is that, you know, any mystical experience you've had while manic, for instance, is invalid because, you know, you have to take medication, which doesn't follow. It's possible to have a valid mystical experience and a valid clinical experience at the same time. And it's, you know, it's confusing. I agree. But it happens to a whole lot of people, and it doesn't help to dismiss us and say that's not a possibility, that we may not have certain spiritual gifts that other people don't. That's entirely possible, right? So I think that's something I wish both the faith community and the mental health community would get together on and start realizing that faith is absolutely an important factor for those of us who have it, in terms of healing and getting to the point we need to be. And there's no reason that you need to make that diametrically opposed to taking medication. My faith teaches me to do whatever I need to do to keep myself well. And if medication is a part of that, absolutely, it teaches me to take it. So the last thing I would want to do is to advise anybody to stop taking any medication, or to say, you know, once you read this book, like, you'll suddenly not have to take your medication. No. Please keep taking your medications. That's definitely not what I'm saying with this. But there's other ways to help us heal. And I don't see why we can't try and harness every single one of those at our disposal.
There are places in the book where you write in quatrains, like Rumi, and you say you aren't doing it deliberately. That's how it's emerging, which leads you to wonder if Rumi's rhyming was the result, not necessarily the cause, of his ecstasy. Would you read the passage where you go into, and I'll let you set it up for us too. You called it a manic episode when we were talking about this earlier. And while you're finding that, let me just say you're listening to Coastline Melody Moisey, author of The Rumi Prescription, How an Ancient Mystic Poet Changed My Modern Manic Life, is with us today. She's also a visiting professor of creative writing at UNCW, and she's answering your questions during the live Wednesday discussion. You can send questions or comments to coastline@whqr.org. And so this passage, Melody.
Yeah, I just want to be clear that this is only a few pages of the book. It doesn't all go on like this. And it wasn't mania as much as what happens when I go manic is I start rhyming a lot. So it became scary that I was doing this, but I kept writing it. It was a kind of sort of inspired weird experience. And I seriously considered cutting this portion from the book, but I didn't because it's so out of line with everything else. But it's about my experience of being in the Pacific Northwest and going there with my husband to just find the beloved in nature and how that happened. So I'll read that portion, which includes a little bit of what you read. So I'll start here. Every day here, I find myself drawing more on and from Rumi's verse, connecting with my source through every living thing, finding the tonic nectar in the bitter sting, making my own way without keeping score, and slowing down to welcome every guest at the door. Here, in this far-flung corner of the continent I call home, the spotty Wi-Fi and crappy cell reception appear to facilitate spiritual connection. Here, the ocean breeze and the enormous trees keep drawing me to my knees. Here, in case you've yet to notice it, I'm rhyming without trying the slightest bit. Maybe that's what happened to Rumi, his rhyming being a result, not the cause of his ecstasy. Whatever the case, this scares the hell out of me because the last time I found myself rhyming inadvertently, the day ended with me in a psychiatric facility. Which of course brings me back to Rumi, as I wonder if he was at all like me. Did he constantly see patterns where others saw lunacy? Did he fear losing touch with reality? Did he risk his reputation to be free? Though this book is the farthest thing from a Rumi biography, I've read enough to suspect the answer would be yes to all three. Perhaps his rhyming was as much a response to insanity as to rhapsody, and based on Rumi's poetry, I doubt that he would disagree. But here's the part where things get tricky. If Rumi had taken lithium or lamotrigine, would he have been able to find the beloved in between? Would the side effects have disturbed his singing and whirling routine? Would his diction, rhyme, and meter have lost their sheen? Would he have just been another scholar regressing to the mean? Of course, I want to disagree because I write and take my meds religiously. But maybe these words would read and sing more brilliantly if I hadn't treated my bipolarity. Maybe I would have written more and better books without the aid of modern psychiatry. Maybe I should have taken fewer trips to the pharmacy. Well, I'm learning to dismiss the five and six. The five and six is what Rumi calls all the outside distractions. So the five senses and the six directions. So while I'm learning to dismiss the five and six, these thoughts in my head are far harder to fix. The racing and rhyming don't need a plug or a signal to function. They run on a ready supply, a steady supply of inner disruption. Useless at best and destructive at worst, they're the kinds of reflections that make me feel cursed. They zip through my head like delinquents on a crime spree. No registration, no insurance, no plates, no ID. But Rumi made his counsel for this clear in the Masnavi. And through the echo of my father's voice, it now returns to me. And this is from Rumi. Abstain from thoughts, my dear friend, for such abstinence is always the best medicine. Quit your scratching, as it only makes the itch worse. Stop it already. Free your soul from this curse.
And I'm not sure if this is part of what you meant here, but, and that's Melody Moisey, by the way, reading from her latest book, The Rumi Prescription, How an Ancient Mystic Poet Changed My Modern Manic Life. But you suggest in other parts in the book that intellect can be a barrier, this coming from a lawyer and an academic herself, a writer, a scholar. Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, intellect really gets in the way a lot, especially if you're good at it. Right? If that's how you define yourself, right? Because that's a source of pride for you. And for me, certainly it was. I think intellect kind of covers up the intuitions that we have. And we don't value intuition as strongly as we do intellect. We can't measure it in the same way, right? And I think the other thing my father kept telling me is, you know, we were in the process of studying together. Was that the words keep getting in your way. You need to stop focusing on the words. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm a writer. Like, that's all I have is words. And he's like, that's not it. And one of the biggest struggles of the book was that I went to my father saying, I'm going to write a book from this. And my father came back to me and said, this is for your life. This isn't for a book. this is something you need to be doing for the rest of your life, and you will be doing for the rest of your life. No spiritual journey ends at some specific date unless you're dead, at which point it's going on just to in another plane, right? but this idea, like the level of hubris I had when I came to my father to learn this poetry, was immense. That's intellect. That's thinking you can do these things. And the thing about the intellect also, it gives the delusion that all of these great, whatever great ideas you have are coming from within, that they're all yours, right? And I think all of the best discoveries and ideas come from opening yourself to something greater than you, right? The best writing in this book is not a result of my intellect or my ability to write. The best writing in this book is the result of me being open to something else writing through me. And I know that sounds super woo-woo, and I'm not like a super woo-woo person, but I genuinely believe it. And if you're not open to that, your writing becomes really stilted. And you don't need to know that you're open to it. You can call it a million different things. Like I call it the beloved or God. Other people call it nature or science or, you know, something that's bigger and greater that you believe in that is working through you. So you can remove your ego from it for a second. And that's when really great things happen.
Hap writes, fortunate to hear Melody Moisey's talk introducing this new book a few months back on campus at WUNC. He says, I purchased two, giving one to Jahan, my Iranian friend who grew up much like you, born in Iran, growing up in America, speaks fluent Farsi. We both love Rumi's poetry, although he grew up with it. Thank you for that, Hap. And we have some more listeners that we're going to hear from when we come back from this next break. You're listening to Coastline. Melody Moisey, author and visiting professor of creative writing at UNCW, is with us today. We're talking about her latest book, The Rumi Prescription. You can ask your own question or make a comment by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Again, we'll take a short break. When we come back, more from listeners. It's the last segment, so you have just a few minutes left to get your own question or comment in during the live Wednesday discussion. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today we're learning about the application of the wisdom from a 13th century mystic poet, Rumi, to a modern 21st century life with Melody Moisey, author of The Rumi Prescription, and a visiting professor of creative writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. If you have a question for Professor Moisey, you can write to us during the live Wednesday discussion at coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And I do want to say we had a listener write in, and I'm not sure she's okay if I share her name, so I'm going to err on the side of caution. She says, loving this interview, where faith and medicine meet is such a great phrase. I have a long history of depression, but there have been aspects of it that were spiritual experiences. And Melody Moisey, you also write about this revelatory moment that you had after which you were hospitalized. But that is still a moment that you look back on as something of a spiritual touchstone, the moment you were no longer the drop and you became part of the ocean. Exactly. So first of all, tell us what happened there.
Sure. I had an acute manic episode and a psychotic break. But before that, you lose track of time when those things happen. Could have been a few hours, could have been a full day. I'm not sure exactly. But I was in a moment just standing on my balcony in Atlanta. I lived in Atlanta at the time, and watching the sunrise over Stone Mountain after not having slept for several days. And I felt that sunlight meet me in a way, not just meet, like every cell inside of my body. And I felt connected not only to that sunlight, but also to every other living thing on the planet and beyond. that I have never felt like that before. And I felt this strong sense of, you know, everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be. Like all your anxiety is for nothing. Like everything is how it's supposed to be. And I just remember such a comfort in that, you know, and to me, that was absolutely a mystical experience, because certainly ever since then, before then, as somebody, you know, who values her intellect, I have always questioned, you know, you always have to be open to questioning. Is there a divine power greater than me? Maybe there isn't. I'm open to that. And I was, until that experience, which had nothing to do with intellect, but until that moment, I was able to entertain that question, right? Like, whereas after that mystical experience, which, you know, quickly descended into mania and psychosis and I needed treatment, but even still, that moment, like that experience, allowed me to never question the beloved's existence within myself and within every other living thing, to the point that if I hurt somebody else, I know that I'm hurting myself because we're connected. That was really powerful for me to realize, and to be able to have, just as somebody again who really values intellect, like basically that was proof of faith for me. And I can't, you know, you can't like explain it in words. You can't explain it in anything but in feeling. And again, it comes back to intuition. It just felt like that the sun had met this intuition that had always lived inside of me and reminded me of it. So yeah, that experience, I wouldn't give it up, even if it meant I wouldn't have had to go through the mania and psychosis. I still wouldn't give it up. And that was really painful. But I wish that I had been able to use that experience in a way that helped in my healing, because it could have helped me a lot. Because, you know, at least this is the silver lining, that the mental health, like, professionals, many of them were just trying to steal from me. And I should say there were some who did hold my hand and pray with me and understood this, but very few.
Well, so you're separating the revelatory moment, that experience of being one with the beloved, from the psychosis that happened after that. Mm-hmm. And you are able, because of your experience in that revelatory moment, to not discount it.
Like, exactly.
You don't delegitimize it, even though mental health professionals afterwards, some were perhaps trying to talk you into delegitimizing it, ignoring it, what?
Yeah, I mean, just talk me into, that's garbage. Like, in the same way that they tried to tell me that, you know, whatever my hallucinations or delusions were also irrelevant. Like, the content of anything that happens while you're manic or psychotic is irrelevant. And some of it certainly is, and is meaningless. But to me, as a person of faith, everything does have some meaning. And stealing meaning from someone is a really, really great way to throw them into depression. Giving somebody who already has a sense of purpose and meaning and saying to them, nope, all your sense of purpose and meaning is garbage, is not real, is delusion. You know, and I, even in the hospital, I've had psychiatrists before, obviously I didn't stay with them, who thought my faith was a delusion and was a symptom. And even in the hospital, there were people who wrote in my hospital records that I had hyper religiosity. Meanwhile, like, I don't even pray five times a day, which is, you know, standard prescription for Muslims. But I wasn't even doing that, and they were calling it hyper religiosity. There's a lot of work that needs to be done in the mental health community.
Yeah, again, bridging that gap between the tools in the mental health field and the tools in religion or mysticism. And you mentioned the silver lining that some mental health professionals talked about with you, and you recognize post-traumatic growth as an important psychological phenomenon, and compare it to Rumi poeticizing this thousands of years ago. He spoke of wounds summoning light. And would you say that your depression has summoned light? And how do we see this in other populations that have been oppressed or marginalized?
Yeah, I agree with it. Rumi says, your wounds may summon the light here too, but this sacred light does not come from you. And what he means is it does not come solely from you. There is a sacred light that whatever suffering you go through invites the beloved into your life. He has so many poems like this. He says, for a viable cure, pain is the key. Your injury invites the remedy. Or break a leg and the beloved grants wings to soar. Fall in a ditch and the beloved opens a door. So many couplets like that. I could go on and on. But that's his philosophy because I think he lived it. And I do think his poetry is deeply inspired. Much of it wasn't written down, but rather spoken while spinning, while in these ecstatic states. So this idea that the place where you're most wounded is the place where you have the most opportunity to grow really spoke to me, both as somebody who has bipolar disorder, but also as somebody who has half a pancreas. I had half of my pancreas removed because I had a tumor when I was 19. So as somebody who, you know, is human and parts of my body start and stop working without me telling them to, it's really comforting. And it's proven true for me.
You know, we talked before about how you've divided your book into afflictions, human afflictions, mm-hmm. and one of those is isolation, which I found particularly relevant during what we're now calling the coronavirus era or the new normal or whatever the hackneyed phrase we're using now for it. But you insist that people are not divided into creatives and non-creatives. I just found that particularly interesting in your isolation chapter. And there are humans who would vigorously argue with you about that. And often in my personal experience, the ones that argue the hardest that there certainly are creatives and non-creatives are the ones who consider themselves non-creatives. Mm. Why is this an important distinction to you?
I think art isn't something you do that we do as humans, just like as bonus. It's not extra credit or like some other part of ourselves that isn't, it's our soul coming to life. And I think the idea that there are these non-creatives just is hilarious to me because all of us, like, even if you're just creating compost, you're creating something. Like if you're dead, your body comes in, like becomes something else. And whatever new you create, whether we recognize it or not, this creativity is in our DNA. And I think it extends far beyond what we allow it to. Because inside of each of us is this valuable and unique thing that we have to contribute to the world. And we can produce something novel if we're open to it. And, you know, I may be more talented in writing than painting, for instance, or than cooking or anything else. But that's my contribution. You know what I mean? And every time I contribute something new to the world, it helps me feel less alone. And not because it's published and people write me and say, you know, I really liked your book and it helped me feel less alone. Like, no, even before that, before it's on anyone's nightstand, you know, I feel connected. And for me, that's the greatest way to fight isolation is to create something new. And if you can do it in groups, even better. And if, like, personally, if I could create music, that's what I would do because that's what touches me the most. Because I feel like it's one of those things that can get past intellect. But I have zero talent in music. So I'm writing.
You also say that anger, Rumi describes it as a trap that can distance us from the whole, but it's also an undeniable part of human existence. What do you think anger tells us, and what's the best way to deal with it, as I ask this question in the midst of possibly the most polarized time, save for the pre-Civil War era in American history? And also, the distinction I want you to really get at is distinguishing between fury for our oppressors versus fidelity to the oppressed.
Mm. Yeah. So as an activist, I started from that fury for our oppressors. That's where I began. And that's how I genuinely believe I landed in several psychiatric hospitals. I burnt out because this kind of anger, and there's a role for anger. I genuinely believe that because it allows you to recognize it's a signal that an injustice is occurring. But when you act out of anger for your oppressor instead of out of love for the oppressed, then you're hurting yourself and you're hurting your cause at the same time. And when I finally realized as an activist that the best weapon I have isn't my anger, it's my ability to love. And not just the people who are on my team too, I should say, like it's my ability to see somebody who disagrees with me deeply in a way that even I can say the way you disagree with me really minimizes and offends me and offends my humanity, right? So an example would be somebody who's rabidly Islamophobic, right? I can look at that person and say, just start getting really angry, you know, or I can look at that person and say something happened to them. Some trauma happened to them that resulted in this, because people don't naturally come out of the womb hating like that. And if you can try and connect with that, and personally, like this is my hope for all the other people who are connected with people who are wildly Islamophobic, who are not, and who are not those people who are not Muslim, like you have a way of connecting with them than maybe I don't, but I would hope, and this is what's been hard in these like divisive times when I find that people say they disown members of their families for having different political views, and then tell me, like, if somebody disowns a member of their family for being Islamophobic or racist or whatever and tells me this as if like I should give them a medal, I that doesn't help me. Like, it would help me a lot more if you didn't disown your uncle and actually sat and listened to him and heard him out like a human being, realizing that there is some trauma behind every source of hatred and fear, and help him with that. Because he's not going to talk to me, you know? So I'm not giving out medals for that. It really bothers me. And I really would hope, and certainly like there are legitimate reasons to disown members of your family. But the fact that they voted for Trump and you didn't, I don't think is it. I personally don't. And I say that as a proud Iranian American Muslim feminist woman.
And an activist too. So you spend, and in your legal career, that has been devoted to working for giving a voice to marginalized people for one reason or another. And yet you're saying, don't get angry at the people who are oppressing them because you won't win anything that way.
Yeah. And you hurt yourself. And I think try and have compassion for them. Try and realize where they're coming from, to the point that you can.
Other than that making you a better person, what is the payoff there? What's the payoff for you in doing that?
It's actually huge, because you realize that when you realize that this is coming from trauma and pain and fear, then you also realize it has nothing to do with you. Like, at all, it has nothing to do with me. Like, maybe somebody has picked Muslims as their devil, and that's, you know, their nemesis and somebody they can fight against, because it's easier to fight against Muslims than your abusive father. You know what I mean? Like, there's something in your history that is worse, but you've chosen to hate a whole group of people, for instance, as a way of dealing with that. And people aren't necessarily aware of that, you know? So I think the result for me is much better, because I'm able to step back and say it has nothing to do with me and everything to do with them.
The book is The Rumi Prescription: How an Ancient Mystic Poet Changed My Modern Manic Life, by Melody Moisey. Melody, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rachel. This was great.
Coastline's production team is led by Rachel Keith and includes Ken Campbell, Doc Jardin, and Marissa Castrino. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, or find it on the HQR app. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.